Good morning. My name is Dominic. If I haven't met you, one of the pastors here, and so glad you're here this morning. And it finally stopped raining. Can you believe that? This is good. I know. I love that. Here we go. We got one little clap there. It finally stopped raining. I've appreciated the rain. I've also appreciated today and no rain. So this is good. We're in the story of Matthew telling the story of Jesus' life on earth. And the interesting thing as we go through this story and as we read and hear about Jesus is that it's not a story that you kind of keep at a distance. Whether you're familiar with this story or not, I hope you hear and I hope you know, or I hope you're ready to know that this is a story that deeply kind of connects with our story. It's not a story that you sit back on and kind of go, well, that's interesting. I like that piece. I don't like that piece. You can kind of critique it from a distance. It's a story, and he's a person that kind of continually to push into who we are, even here today, several thousand years after the fact. And today we're going to look at a part of Jesus' story as he's heading towards the cross where he encounters three different types of people. And again, it's a type of story. These three people that he meets on the way to the cross, these three people that are part of his story on the way to the cross are actually somehow in some way kind of embody a little bit of what it means to be human. They kind of embody that something in us and in our humanity seems a bit off. Whatever your belief or whatever your viewpoint, whatever your philosophy, whatever your religion, I think we could probably all look at different points in our world or within the stories of our world and go, that seems a bit off. You could point to different places and that seems a bit strange or broken or painful or whatever word you want to use. And so what I want to do today through the scenes that we're going to read about Jesus' movement towards the cross is I want to kind of take us through these scenes through the lens of three people or three types of people. And these three types of people are kind of going to be an image for us of something in us and in our culture and in our humanity that I think if we're honest, like deep down, we know like needs to change. And then what I'm going to do is I want us to see Jesus' response to all this. Because as you're going to see, his response is actually pretty simple. He doesn't show up quite a lot, actually, in the next set of verses. So we're going to look at his response to the three people that he met on the way to the cross. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 27. The words will be on the screen above me. You can follow along on your phone. You can also listen with your ears as I read it. Matthew chapter 27. Three scenes as Jesus heads towards the cross and the situation where Jesus is being brought before Pilate on sort of a trial of sorts, of sort of an examination of what should happen to Jesus. Three people we meet on the way. The first people or a person, the type of person we're going to meet in this story is embodied by the chief priests and elders, the religious leaders of Jesus' day. And the religious leaders of Jesus' day, as I read this story, stand out to me because they kind of represent and they live out this incongruent spirituality. Like something seems a bit off in how they understand their righteousness or morality or spirituality. Listen to this, the first set of verses that Matthew tells us of what happened to Jesus. Verse 1, chapter 27 of Matthew. Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people made their plans how to have Jesus executed. So they bound him, led him away, handed him over to Pilate the governor. When Judas, who had betrayed Jesus, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders. That's what he had received for betraying Jesus. He says, "I have sinned, for I have betrayed innocent blood." "What is that to us?" the leaders say. "That is your responsibility." So Judas threw the money into the temple, left, and then he went away and hanged himself. The chief priest picked up the coins and said, "It is against the law to put this into the treasury since it is blood money." Do you get what's happening here? Like they're like, hey, we're planning a murder in verse 1. Verse 6, you know what? I don't know. This money, we probably should put in a different department. Like that doesn't really fit in our budget. That doesn't really fit in our spiritual boxes here. But murder seems okay. Verse 7, so they decide to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. Again, seems like, well, that's interesting, like some act of justice, some place that someone who comes to this area could find a resting place if they happen to pass away. This seems all very good, and at the same time, we're realizing these are the same people in verse 1. Something seems a bit off. That is why it's been called the field of blood to this day. Verse 9, that was what was Jeremiah the prophet fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field as the Lord commanded me. Something seems a bit off in what they're doing. There seems to be like this incongruent spirituality. There seems to be, we would almost call it like a lack of integrity. In other words, integrity, this thing about us, this integralness that at times it can get broken between what we say and how we act, that what we present to the world and how we act may be a bit off. And it seems that way for these religious leaders, that who they claim to be and how they act are two different things. Maybe you can picture people in your life, maybe somewhere in your story. You've encountered maybe even religious people who have, you kind of felt like they're claiming one thing. Maybe they're people like me. Maybe it's, you feel like it is me, that they're claiming some sort of thing out here, and behind the scenes they're living a totally different way. Maybe you have people in your life who like just claim to be the most loving, moral standing people in the world, and at the same time they've got a whole group of people that they hate and that they ignore. Whatever your story, you maybe you've encountered, maybe you have felt that in your own life, that something seems a bit off. It seems incongruent. It seems disintegrated when it should be brought together. The first people, the first person, the first type of people that Jesus meets on the way to the cross, these religious leaders, are people whose spirituality somehow started to break apart. The second person that we meet on the way to the cross is Pilate. Pilate. Now, we know a little bit about Pilate from history. Pilate was the prefect or governor of Judea during this time, and actually in the 1960s in Caesarea, a stone was uncovered by archaeologists that actually have Pilate's name engraved from that particular time. We know this. We know this from different writers who have actually talked about Pilate in throughout history and have given us a bit of glimpse into Pilate and bit into his character. In fact, one ancient historian described Pilate this way. He said, Pilate was a man of very inflexible disposition and of most ferocious passions. There was an aggressiveness about Pilate. Yes, he was governor. He was probably a little bit on the young side, maybe his early 30s even. He's one who had risen through the ranks. There was an aggressiveness about him. There was an inflexible disposition about his character. And actually, Pilate also, even though he was governor of the region, he had a very complicated relationship with the Jewish people. And a lot of it stemmed around conflict. Josephus, the ancient historian, tells us two examples that we can see Pilate's aggression and complicated relationship with the Jewish people. The first one is, it involved Roman standards. Roman standards were these huge poles that had these circular kind of discs on them, and as the army marched, or if it conquered an area, it would establish or march with these standards in front of it, kind of like, this is who's coming in to take over. This was their propaganda. And Pilate's predecessor, who was ruling before him, when that person had the standards brought into Jerusalem, they left those circular plaques blank. Normally those plaques would have the image of Caesar, of the emperor, but out of respect for the Jewish people and their law that there should be no graven images, they left those blank. So the image is still there, just not explicit. Well, when Pilate took over, one of the first things he did is that literally overnight, we're told from Josephus, that he went and had the image of Caesar reaffixed to the standard. So the next morning, the Jewish people woke up in the middle of their holy place with something blatantly against who they were. They were so upset and angry, a delegation went to Pilate. And Pilate, sensing that maybe a riot was about to unfold, he kind of quietly asked his soldiers to kind of surround the gathering as they were protesting against him. And at a cue, when Pilate gave the scene, all of these soldiers in full gear kind of rose up around surrounding the Jewish people who had come to protest this act. They were not deterred. They actually, Josephus says, bared their neck. And they said, you know what? If you want to kill us, kill us. We don't think this is right. Pilate thankfully relented. But you can tell there's this intersection between Pilate's aggression and the Jewish people. Another story, kind of similar. There was a time when Pilate wanted to build an aqueduct to get some better water into the area, which is great. But in order to pay for the aqueduct, Pilate took money from the Jewish temple, the holy money, that kind of interchange. Maybe you remember Jesus and the money changers. There was this money that was used as kind of an offering, as a gift to God. And Pilate just went ahead and took it for his own purposes. Jewish people and leaders were furious. And they came to Pilate, kind of a similar scene like this, right when he was in Jerusalem. And they came to him protesting and upset. And Pilate, he's no dummy. He knows what's about to happen. Pilate senses that there's about to be conflict. So this time, instead of getting the army surrounding the people, what he does in Jerusalem is he tells his army to dress up in civilian clothes, kind of find their way through the crowd. And he gives a signal, and out they come with these wooden clubs and attack the mob. An aggressive person, a complicated relationship with the Jewish people in the least. This is who Pilate is. And as we encounter this, we see, I think, Pilate clouded by this history, clouded by this experience. And so so hindered by it that it clouds his judgment with Jesus. Watch this. We know from Matthew here that Pilate seems to understand what's going on. He seems impressed by Jesus, and he seems to understand what's going on. Look at verses 11 through 18. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, this is Pilate, and then Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Well, when he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony that they are bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply. Not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. He's impressed by Jesus and his response, or lack thereof. Now, it was the governor's custom at the festival to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a well-known prisoner whose name was Jesus Barabbas. And when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah?" Verse 18, watch this. For he knew it was out of self-interest that they had handed Jesus over to him. Pilate knows something. He's impressed by Jesus, and he also knows why this entire scene is going on. In fact, that's probably not necessarily a guess on Matthew's part. We know after Pilate, the successor to Pilate, one of the first things that person does, comes into Jerusalem and gets rid of Caiaphas. Like almost that there was this idea that Pilate and Caiaphas, the high priest, were a little bit more in collaboration than probably we even know. So Pilate understands what's going on. He realizes why this scene's coming. And even himself, he's impressed by Jesus. And yet he kind of throws all that away and acts completely different. You kind of wonder, like, maybe his history has clouded his judgment in this moment. Watch how the strange he acts, even though he's impressed by Jesus, even though he understands why this entire thing is happening, he acts in ways that just seem really strange. First thing he does is his wife sends him a message, and he disregards his message, which we could just end the sermon right there. That's enough of a strange action on his part. Pilate didn't listen to her. She said, "Don't have anything to do with this innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." Pilate seems to ignore her warning. Not only that, but Pilate shuffles off the responsibility that's his. Listen to the next set of verses in verse 20. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. "Which of the two do you want me to do? What you want me to release to you?" asked the governor. "Barabbas," they answered. "Well, what shall I do then with Jesus who is called the Messiah?" He seems, all of a sudden, he doesn't know how to make decisions. All of a sudden, he's forgotten how to lead. They answered, "Crucify him." "But why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." And then watch this, verse 24. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting. He knows what's going on. This has happened already at least twice before. Not this again. You can imagine him saying to himself. He takes water and washed his hands in front of the crowd and says, "This is your responsibility. I'm innocent of this. It's all yours." All the people answered, "His blood is on us and our children." Then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. Pilate knows what's going on. he's impressed by Jesus, and at the same time, he acts in contrary ways. He seems so hung up on his past that he's clouded for present decisions. He does something that no one can do. You can't just say, like, I'm not responsible anymore. It's part of leadership. It's part of adult life, is that you, like, are responsible for certain things. As a parent, you can't just say, you know what, I don't really want to be responsible for my children today. It just, you have that responsibility. It's silly. It doesn't make any sense. It's actually not true. Pilate can't just say, I don't want anything to do with this. But he had gotten so lost, I think, in his history up to this point that it clouded his present judgment. He acted in fear. He rejected what he saw and knew in order to keep the peace. First person you meet on the way to the cross are religious leaders whose spirituality just seems a bit disintegrated. Second person you meet is Pilate, who's stuck in his past and can't make a clear decision in the present. The third person we meet is embodied by this group of people, the soldiers. Watch this, verse 27. Then the governor's soldiers, Pilate's soldiers, took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And then they twisted together a crown of thorns, set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him, mocked him. Hail, King of the Jews, they said. They spit on him and took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. And after they had mocked him, they took off the robe, put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. The soldiers are interesting people in this narrative because the soldiers are outsiders. These weren't people, these weren't Jewish soldiers. These were Roman soldiers who had come from some other part of the Roman Empire, some other region, some other people group, maybe even some other language potentially, some other religious background, certainly. And here they are as outsiders stepping into the Jesus story and causing pain. The soldiers are outsiders who are perpetuating the tragedy. They've stepped into a story of which they have no context, no experience, no connection, and yet they are part of the ones bringing the pain in the moment. Maybe you can think about people in your life. Maybe you have that family member that, like, they say that one thing in that one way over the Thanksgiving meal table, and it just, like, wrecks the rest of your weekend. Maybe you have that person at work that, like, you're just, oh, I can't believe I have that meeting with them every single week, because every week they just come in and they just kind of unload and then walk out, and everyone's left to pick up the pieces. These soldiers represent and embody this type of person that kind of comes into a place as an outsider, creates havoc and maybe even pain, and then walks away. Three people on the way to the cross, religious leaders who lack integrity, Pilate who's stuck in the past, soldiers who are outsiders and yet perpetuate the tragedy of insiders and of the present. And I think if you read this story, as I've read this story, and I've kind of, like Jerome said earlier, I've grown up around this and heard this story, and we kind of read past this story, and we go, yeah, those are all really bad people. Yeah, those are people I don't want to be like, and shame on them, and all this stuff, and we kind of put them in an other category. But I think if you read this, and if you listen to this, and maybe later today you can go back and reread this, to me, if you didn't have any knowledge of this, or maybe if you really kind of just said, like, I want to read this from a fresh perspective, to me, two things would stand out. Reading these stories. The first thing that would stand out to me is that something is deeply wrong with humanity. I mean, if there are religious leaders whose integrity is broken, if there are the pilots of the world who are so stuck in their past that they can't deal and make decisions and be clear in the present, if there are outsiders in the world who come in and create pain in places they shouldn't and they don't have any context, the first thing that stands out to me is, like, what is wrong with us? Like, what's wrong with us at a core, like, human level? Like, to me, I read these three people and something just goes, like, gosh, something needs to change. I mean, maybe you've been listening to this for the last 20 minutes or whatever, and you're going, you've had this, like, person in mind You're like, oh, I know who the religious leader is in my life. Oh, I could tell you a story about the pilot of my life. Or I've got the soldiers. Maybe I'm still dealing with those soldiers right now. I bet you probably have had someone in your mind this entire time. And maybe like me, you're like, what is wrong with us as human beings? That's the first thing that stands out to me reading this. The second thing, though, is a little bit deeper. The second thing, as you read this story, as you consider this action against Jesus, the second thing that stands out to you if you're reading this is that you realize this isn't simply a story about other people. It's not necessarily a story about these religious leaders back then, although they were there. It isn't necessarily a story about Pilate, although he was there. It wasn't necessarily a story about the soldiers, although it is there. It's not necessarily a story about that person in your life, that family member, that coworker that comes to mind when you hear these types of people. It's not necessarily a story about them. It's not a story that you and I keep at a distance. It's not a story that you and I critique and go, well, what about that and that, and that's why I didn't like that person. It's not a story that you feel better justified in. If you're reading this, I think if you're reading this with fresh eyes, you realize there's another layer to this story, is that the three people on the way to the cross are not only the religious leaders and Pilate and the soldiers, those three people are also us. The three people on the way to the cross, the people who lack integrity, the people who are stuck in their past, the people who step into a situation, create havoc, and walk away are people just like us. I live incongruent. I get stuck in my past. I step into places and create havoc. And so do you. It's easy to stand on the side and go, what is wrong with all those people? And not realize, no, we're right there with them. We're in this camp too. What's astounding to me reading this story and what happens to Jesus is that this isn't simply a story about other people who have gotten it all wrong and I look down upon, or you look down upon. It's reading and realizing the three people that Jesus meets on the way to the cross is us. That's why, to me, the Judas character, Judas in this, is so compelling. I mean, a lot of people think like, hey, Judas, I would never do what Judas did. If I was back there 2,000 years ago, I would have never done what Judas did. I actually think we're probably a little bit more connected to Judas than I think we realize. Look at this. Judas, earlier in the story, he gives back. He has this moment where he has regret, and so he gives back the coins. It's like this act where he's like, I want to undo this pain I've caused. I want to undo everything I've set in motion. That somehow in Judas, I think he gets that something's wrong and that something is wrong in him. And this image of giving back the coins, it's kind of like, can we just start over? Because notice, the giving back of the coins wasn't like to free Jesus. It wasn't like, hey, if I give you back these 30 pieces of silver, can we just like unwind this and you trade me Jesus and I'll give you the coins and we can... No. He says, I have sinned. He says there's something in him that he's trying to undo. There's something in Judas that has gone wrong. To give back the coins was to set himself free, not Jesus. I think he got to a point where he knew something is deeply wrong in me. And I don't know what to do other than to somehow try to give back these coins. I think Judas acts in ways that are probably a lot more familiar to us than we would care to admit. One Bible commentator made this observation about Judas and about this act that you and I are right in the middle of it so many times. He says, the strange thing about sin, which is life outside of the design of God, the strange thing about the ways that we tend to go our own way is that people like you and me, people like Judas can come to hate the very thing they gained by it. You would think Judas would be happy. But there's something in him that went deeply wrong. And he got to a place and he said, something in me needs to change. Can you just take it back? Can we just unwind the picture? Judas found himself as one of those people on the way to the cross. He's probably a lot more familiar to us than we would admit. And of course, you read this, and you read these three people, and then you connect with Judas and that character, and you realize there's one more figure in this, and that's the person of Jesus. Like, how does Jesus respond to this? How does Jesus respond to the religious leaders? How does Jesus respond to Pilate? How does Jesus respond to the soldiers? How does Jesus respond to this broken humanity and the people, the real life people who are enacting it out? How does Jesus respond? Two things stand out to me. One is that he responds in silence. In the face of accusations, he responds in silence. Mark talked last week that this silence is not like he forgot what to say, but it's this act of him saying, you know, what's coming is part of the story of God. It's the design of God. I'm going to surrender to that. I'm choosing to believe that there's something going on here more than everyone sees that's happening. And the other thing that Jesus does, not only the silence, but he also endures the suffering. Jesus endures the suffering. The writer of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 12, he makes a statement about Jesus and his suffering. He says, Jesus is for the joy that was set before him, that Jesus endured the cross. He endured because he saw something good was about to come. Not everything in life should be endured. But if God is doing something through this experience that's for good and bringing good into the world, Jesus is aware of that. He's like, this is worth enduring. Jesus saw something good happening in the midst of this chaos, and he was willing to endure. He was willing to scorn the shame, to push aside everything that the religious leader type people and the pilot type people and the soldier type people were saying about him or were pressing in upon him. He says, you know what? I'm going to put that aside and I'm going to take up and rest in and embrace my identity in God. He sits down at the right hand of the Father. This is someone who sees a story different than the story that everyone else sees. This is someone facing pain and suffering from people that you and I encounter all the time and chooses a different way. Jesus believed the story of God was different than what everyone saw around him. And if you follow that out, I mean, this is just it's so interesting thinking it through this way. Because then you start to see that who Jesus died for. That you realize as you follow this out, as you follow that and realize that this figure of Jesus, that Jesus is not simply dying for some other type of people, but like the religious leaders whose spirituality is disingenuous, a pilot who's stuck in his past, the soldiers who are outsiders bringing pain and perpetuating tragedy, these are the very people Jesus died for. Like you realize the people who sent Jesus to the cross are the same ones that he hung there for. Maybe you start to see the story of God is a lot different than maybe we tend to make it. That the people on the way to the cross are the people for whom Jesus went to the cross for. These are the people. Jesus died for these types of people, and he died for people like you and me. That in all the ways that we've embraced this type of humanity, in all the ways of our religious leader incongruency, in all the ways that we're stuck in our past and ruin our present, in all the ways that we step into situations and perpetuate tragedy, in all those ways where we go like, I'm doing something in the world that isn't good, it's that type of person, it's you and me that Jesus died for. The people on the way to the cross that Jesus meets, the people that he sends, that sent him to the cross, are the very ones for whom he went. It's a shocking story. It's a story of grace. It's a story not simply of 2,000 years ago. It's a story of right now when we realize we're part of those three people. That the people that Jesus died for on the cross are people like you and me. Author and pastor Eugene Peterson said it this way about salvation, this big idea about salvation. I love this idea. He says, the work of salvation takes place in the ruins of broken commitments and the rubble of deteriorated loyalties. The work of salvation takes place in the ruins of broken commitments and the rubble of deteriorated loyalties. If you feel like a religious leader today, disconnected, disintegrated, if you feel like someone whose past is continuing to cloud their future and how you interact with people, if you feel like that person who steps into situations creates pain, if you feel like you're right there, that's the place where salvation happens. If you feel like, well, I'm as far from God as I could possibly be, doesn't he know that I'm one of those three? Yes, he does. And you're closer than you ever imagined. They are the people who sent Jesus to the cross, and Jesus went to the cross to turn around and come get them again. That is grace. That is grace for them. It's grace for you that in the midst of your ruins, in the midst of your rubble, is a place where Jesus starts to bring change. And so today we take communion. We take communion and we do this every month. And part of taking communion is doing a couple things. One is that communion reminds. Communion is an act, a long-standing act that at its core is all about remembering, because we get to places where we start acting like the religious leaders. We get to places where we start acting like Pilate again. We get to places where we start acting like the soldiers. And this is a reminder that says, hang on, we're part of a different story. Let's scorn the shame. Let's push that aside. Let's embrace a new reality, a new identity, something that's changed in our world. And so this act of communion is an act of remembering. Not just like, oh, okay, I got it. I remember that verse. It's starting to change how we think and engage in the world. But there's something else, I think, in this act that I want you to consider and reflect on as you take communion today, is that this act of communion is, yes, it's an act of remembrance, but it's also, I think, an act of rebuilding. That, as Eugene Peterson said, of like, if it's the ruins and then the rubble where salvation happens, then salvation starts to rebuild. That like, as we, I love how we sing earlier, I will build my life upon your love. Which is like, you think, oh, that's a really nice sentiment. No, no, no. That statement's actually quite profound, because the love of God is demonstrated in Jesus going to the cross and then turning around and going back for all the people who led him there. That's love. And so if we're going to build our life on that, it means in the midst of the ruins and the rubble, God starts to do a work of grace. So when you come today to take and celebrate communion, you're doing an act of remembrance. You're kind of rethinking, rewiring in new ways, but you're also doing an act of rebuilding. You're doing an act of says, you know what, God? I've lived in those three ways for far too long. And I choose something new today. I don't deserve it. None of them deserved it. And certainly nor do I. But I'm going to start today with your love, with that type of grace that comes back for me. And as I think about that, maybe as after you take communion today, maybe you just come back to your seat and maybe you just kind of do an act where you just kind of open your hands. Kind of hard to do that when you're holding bread and dipping. So just later when you do that, maybe just during that last song or at some point before you leave, you just kind of relax your grip a bit. Because sometimes we feel like, yeah, I'm going to go after you, God, and we miss the fact that he's come after you. And maybe sometimes you just need to go, I receive it today. Maybe communion is for you to receive and let him rebuild the work of your life. Just some instructions, if you've not been familiar with us taking communion here, you're going to come down these aisles here, and then around the sides, we're going to have ushers who will help kind of guide you through a big gap in chairs so you don't stumble and trip. But we have tables here. We have actually a lot of space here. Every week is a bit different. But today we have a lot of space. We have chairs here. If you want to take communion with your spouse, you can do that. If you want to take it with a group of friends, if you want to take it by yourself, if you want to stay up here for the last song, if you want to sit there and pray, it doesn't matter. You create this space. Take this space however you want. If you just want to pray here, you can do that. Whatever works for you. whatever it can be, to open your hands and allow God to rebuild in the ruins and in the rubble, because that's the place where he is. You don't have to be ashamed anymore. You can embrace a new identity. So I want to pray for us, and then after I'm done praying, when you're ready, you can come down and take communion. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for the incredible gift of love that we build our life upon, that we trust that in the midst of ways that we've lived incongruent, that we've lived stuck in our past, that we create chaos in our present world, that it is in the midst of those places that you bring salvation. It is to people just like us that you bring change. And so often, God, we think we have to be just a bit better than the others, and we don't realize we're right with them. Thank you for this gift of grace that this causes us to open our hands. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that the people who drove Jesus to the cross are the ones who received the free gift of life. It doesn't make sense that we're part of that story. But we marvel in that grace, and would you, God, sink that into us today? Would we see that you are doing a good work in us and in this world, and would we build our life on that as we open our hands to you? In Jesus' name.